The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 27th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
I'm Monocle's Paige Reynolds in Kyiv, and I'll be here with the latest on what the mood is on the ground.
We'll be hearing from our team in Kyiv and from our security correspondent as the West continues to prepare for possible military confrontation with Russia. Then US Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is retiring. Who will Joe Biden pick to succeed him? Plus, there's a new issue of Monocle magazine out today. Knock, knock. Who's there? It's our editor-in-chief. He'll be here to tell us all about it. And finally, it's Thursday, which can only mean one thing. Isn't that right, Fernando?
Buona ziua, Tom. For today's global countdown, we're heading to the sixth most populous member state of the European Union.
Good clue, Fernando. More from him a little later. And plenty more besides ahead on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. We begin today's programme in Ukraine, where efforts are continuing to prepare the country for a military confrontation with Russia. It comes as leaders in Washington and Moscow trade barbs over whether Ukraine could ever become a NATO member. At present, of course, Ukraine's not part of the alliance, which means that NATO is under no obligation to defend it should Russia attempt an invasion. Well, let's get more on this now with Benno Zog, Monocle 24's security correspondent, who joins us from our Zurich HQ. Also on the line, on the ground from Kyiv, is Monocle 24's reporter and producer, Paige Reynolds. A warm welcome to you both and good afternoon from London. Paige, I'll cross to you first of all. You've scarcely been there 24 hours, but share some of your first impressions since you touched down in Kyiv yesterday.
Good afternoon, Tom. You're right. I've been here just about 24 hours and it's been a total whirlwind. When Chris and I checked in on the daily last night, we'd just been to Maidan Nezalezhnosti, Independence Square, where the Revolution of Dignity took place in 2013-2014. And it was interesting to be back again, you know, on the precipice, potentially of something else that could be as destructive, potentially in an albeit different way. The mood was calm, however. It was quiet. The people that we spoke to didn't seem to be too alarmed. After we checked in, we then went to meet Mark Wilkins. Now, listeners of The Globalist would have heard a little bit of this interview. He's a Swiss filmmaker who has co-founded a gallery and a restaurant here. We met in his gallery. It's an amazing space on Rotarska Street, which has a really rich history of being kind of Kyiv's artistic centre. We had dinner with Mark and his wife, and we were also joined by chance by someone from the Ministry of Defence who specifically works within sort of the hybrid warfare and disinformation sphere. Super interesting to get her perspective on things. The line from her very much that, you know, Ukraine has been at this since 2014, and we're the best in the business. They're the best in the business when it comes to their knowledge of how to counter these types of threats. What they're lacking really is resource. So we'll be following up with her and some of her team tomorrow, so you can hear more of that then.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Paige. And Benno, in Zurich, let me bring you here in. On this point, actually, I guess this general sort of proficiency in dealing with dis and misinformation in Ukraine that's well practiced, as Paige says, over a number of years. Does that potentially explain why there seems to be something of a disconnect between the urgency, the sort of febrile coverage a little bit of the situation, certainly in Western media, and then this atmosphere on the ground, in Kiev in particular, which seems, I don't know, it's much more quotidian. There seems to be less urgency. Is that because, to generalise, Ukrainians are more confident at their own facility to deal with this kind of pressure?
Generalizations are obviously hard, but I think that there is a certain factor there that Ukrainian people, and many emphasize that in-person interactions on Twitter and so on, have been used to living in this state of hybrid attacks against its country. We've seen cyber attacks against Ukraine. We've obviously seen Russian incursions by annexing Crimea, by moving into the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. So there's these factors have always been very present. And at the same time, yes, the media space in Ukraine is obviously in between somewhat it having its own space between Western media, with Russian media having quite some influence depending on the region and the country. For example, I just saw recent statistics, half of Ukraine's Instagram users tweet or use Instagram and write in Russian. So certainly language, this linguistic connection and family ties and so on have an effect. But the biggest factor I would really argue why situation may be a little calm is on the one hand that for 7 years Ukraine has been in this state, unfortunately, but also that the government is very clear in its messaging. For example, the Kiev government has almost criticized the US and the UK and others who are evacuating part of their embassy staff from Kiev, saying this is exaggerated, the threat is not that real, particularly not in the capital. And President Zelensky has also said that Russian troops in Belarus, who are currently there for exercises, will not pose a threat from the north. So there's certainly a government effort to keep things quiet and avoid panic, of course, even were things to escalate further.
Well, Benno, let me just ask you a bit more about the geopolitical picture, because it's interesting to reflect on diplomatic efforts. The US letter, this statement, which is not being made public, but it talks about a serious diplomatic path out of the crisis, which is perhaps the language one might expect. Is that a vainglorious notion that at this stage there can be a serious diplomatic solution? Or do you think the fact that we have these written representations from the US, from NATO as a collective, answering Russian demands, reflects, I don't know, some residual confidence, in certain quarters at least, that there could be a solution of this character?
Interestingly, part of this serious diplomatic path is the seriousness that comes with written responses in the first place, written responses that are not disclosed, I think, on mutual request. So we don't know exactly what the US sent to Russia, and we will probably not learn about the exact Russian reply, which we can expect again in written form in the next couple of weeks or so. So there's certain seriousness there. If Antony Blinken, for example, the US foreign minister, says that serious diplomacy is at play, this can be mildly reassuring. It may indicate that there's a certain willingness on the US's part to offer certain, I wouldn't call them concessions, but certain offers to Russia that may be of mutual interest. And an indication has been in NATO's written response, yet again, written, very serious, where there was indication that communication formats should be re-established between Russia and NATO. Offices mutually in Brussels and in Moscow should be reopened. And there should indeed be talks about military exercises, about deployments, particularly of missiles, and so on. So potential new arms control treaty is limiting deployments of certain weapon systems in Europe, limiting certain presence of, let's say, US troops or equipment may still be out there. And this is, in a way, as serious as it can get, because we were confronted with these maximalist demands on Russia's part. Mm. And everyone was worried how, given these demands that are outlandish, one can even react in a serious diplomatic manner. So we'll see. It's certainly not moving as quickly as we may hope or we may have anticipated. This will still take weeks, certainly for the diplomatic path and maybe also for the potential military that can happen at the same time, unfortunately.
Well, back to Kiev, and Paige, let me bring you back in here. It's interesting to reflect, of course, or imagine, speculate perhaps a little on what the governmental responses might look like, what the discourse, what the discussions are. I know you spoke to a former member of parliament, well, either this morning or last night as well. Tell us a little bit what she had to say.
Yeah, so we just spoke with him sort of in the last 45 minutes, the activist and former MP Yulia Maruševska. She's a really interesting figure. Some people might remember a video that went viral during the Maidan movement called I Am a Ukrainian. Well, it was Yulia at only 22 who did that video. It went viral and it was essentially a call to arms for people in the West to not ignore the plight of Ukrainians who simply want to live a normal life. And I guess that sentiment does echo some way with what's happening right now. And that's what she said to us. I said, well, you know, what do Ukrainians want? They say they just want to be able to live normally like we do. She was only 22 when she made this video. She went on to be one of the youngest members of parliament in Ukraine. She was head of customs in Odessa under Mikhail Saakashvili, the Ukrainian-Georgian politician. She kind of led this reform program that was successful, but they couldn't scale it up, I think, just because of the level of corruption that was sort of in other parts of Ukraine's political system. So she took a step back, but she had some really interesting insights into the perception of the threat from normal Ukrainians and also from Ukrainians who are working kind of much more closely at the heart of politics. And we'll be hearing that interview tonight on The Daily.
Yeah, well, looking forward to that one, Paige, and indeed to more dispatches from yourself and, of course, from Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak, who I know is alongside you in Kiev. Just a quick note, what else do you have in your, I know, very busy and fairly urgently restructured diary this afternoon and in the days ahead? I know you've got a very, very hectic schedule, but just give us a couple of things that are on the radar for you.
Yes, indeed, Tom. It's very much, it's very fluid, I think, with the amount of kind of people we're going out and meeting. And what's been great, I think, since we've arrived is we've, you know, we've had a few people and through that we've been connected to such a web of interesting people here. So we're lining up interviews kind of all the time. My phone has not stopped going off. Chris and I are going our separate ways. We've already parted this afternoon for the first time. Chris is heading to the university here in Kiev to speak with Dr. Maxim Yakovlev. He's the chair of international relations there. And I'm going to be heading back into the centre of town near the Golden Gate district to meet with the head of the Osnovy publishing house here, Dana Pavlichka, to get kind of another sort of slightly left field view on what's happening. We're hoping to speak to people who work within disinformation tomorrow, which will be a very interesting chat given kind of the chat we had last night. But yeah, things are fluid here and changing all the time. So we'll have to update you later, Tom.
Well, we know that you're just on the end of the line, which is always good for us. Paige, I'll leave you to your day. Benno Zogin-Zirik, though, let me come back to you, maybe just for a couple of final thoughts on this one. Is it starting to coalesce in your mind? You can hear from the way Paige is talking about the mood on the ground. There remains so much uncertainty. There's lots of, there's a lack of clarity, I guess, in terms of the timetabling. In your mind, though, Benno, from the conversations you're having both within and without Switzerland, and I know, obviously, you speak to people frequently in Belarus also, are you getting a sense of what the next key moment might be, what the next key inflection point might be, and indeed where that might be, whether it's something that happens in Moscow or in Kiev or actually in the Donbass or towards the Belarusian border? Are you getting a sense now of what the timetable here might at least look like?
You sound slightly confused and overwhelmed in a way, and so am I, and so are other observers, because there's so much out there. These very big grey power questions of Russia's place in Europe, the United States' place in Europe, where Ukraine is going, how it may be affected, loads of treaties and treaty proposals and so on arms control and missiles, while at the same time there's Russian troops amassing at the border in Belarus as well for exercises, while NATO supports with arms, with trainers, the Ukrainian side and so on. So it is overwhelming and it is moving very many things are moving at the same time. It's very much a moving target. So while obviously I would look out for the structural things, is this Russia's written response to the US and NATO, for example, the next meeting that are coming up in 2 weeks in Berlin, for example, the Normandy format on Ukraine, on the Ukraine peace process, all of these things, but obviously always have an eye open for some kind of surprises, let's say additional deployments, the sending or deployment of new weapon system that we haven't seen in the region, or all of a sudden testing balloons as well from certain experts, from certain policymakers, all of a sudden suggesting new potential treaties or elements that may be included in diplomatic talks. It is as messy as the situation on the ground, the kind of debate we're having. So the picture is really big, but it's also so great to have Paige and Chris on the ground in Kyiv to give a bit of a sense of the mood on the ground, because otherwise you can easily be lost in the grey power talks just as much.
Benno, you're not wrong. It is very complex. I do find it a little overwhelming, but I'm always reassured and better informed by talking to you. So thank you, Benno, in Zurich. That was our friend Benno Zog in Zurich. Before that, Paige Reynolds reporting on the ground in Kyiv. Right now, let's cross to our own Marco Sippi. He's standing by here in London with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Tom. An alliance led by Kurdish militia has regained full control of a prison in northeastern Syria, which was seized by Islamic State militants a week ago. At least 189 people have reportedly been killed in clashes since IS tried to stage a mass breakout at the prison. All the inmates in the jail have now surrendered. Face coverings and COVID passes are no longer legally required in England after the UK government said that it was relaxing the measures. England's Health Secretary Sajid Javid said the government's decision was due to the success of the vaccine rollout and a better understanding of COVID treatments. Lebanon has struck an agreement with Jordan and Syria that will make it easier to import electricity into Lebanon's power-starved capital, Beirut. It is understood the move will give Lebanon 2 extra hours of mains power a day. You can find out more about the agreement at monocle.com/minute. And Germany has appointed a commissioner for the acceptance of sexual and gender diversity. The Green Party's Sven Lehmann will oversee a national action plan, with the new agreement stating that Germany should become a pioneer in the fight against discrimination. Those are the day's headlines. Now back to you, Tom.
Thank you very much indeed, Marcus. And it is just 16 minutes past midday here in London, 16 minutes past 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C. And it is to the United States we head now, where President Joe Biden has confirmed that he intends to honour his commitment to make an African-American woman his first nomination to the Supreme Court. Biden's nominee would replace the liberal justice, Stephen Breyer, who's expected to retire this summer. Well, let's get more on this now. I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line by Julie Norman, co-director of University College London's Centre on US Politics. Welcome back to the briefing, Julie. Always good to hear from you. And it's true, isn't it, that Biden had pretty much sort of telegraphed his intention should there be the opportunity to appoint a new justice. What are you expecting this succession to look like?
Well, Tom, yes, we did hear from Biden really early on in the campaign that this would be one of his pledges for if he became president would be to appoint a black woman to the Supreme Court, to be the first black woman appointed. He repeated that pledge throughout his campaign, and the White House confirmed yesterday that he indeed plans to stick by that. We hear from Democrats that they're hoping to move this nomination and confirmation process through pretty quickly. So it's possible that everything could be confirmed by June or July when the current term ends. It's important to note that this nomination won't change the overall makeup of the court, which is still split 6-3 with a conservative majority. But it is still important for Democrats to maintain those seats that that are left-leaning for their priorities and interests. Biden has a shortlist that's kind of buzzing around with different names who are on it. There's a few individuals who are expected to be very high on that list. One is Ketanji Brown Jackson. She is a graduate of Harvard Law School. She clerked for Justice Breyer in the past, which is a pretty notable link just with him retiring now. And she's currently on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. So she was appointed there by Biden, which means she just went through the Senate confirmation process last year and did so with bipartisan support. Another potential candidate is Leandra R. Kruger. She also clerked in the past for another justice, John Paul Stevens, graduate of Yale Law School, and currently sits on the California Supreme Court. So those are a couple of the names that are being discussed, but obviously there are others as well that are presumably on Biden's list. So we'll probably hear more about that selection process in these coming days and weeks.
Yeah, Julian, I've got a playful question to ask you about a potential appointment to this role, which I'll do in a moment. But just to go back to that point you said about the 6-3 split, it doesn't change that fundamentally. To what extent, though, and maybe we need to cite appropriately, given we're talking about the law courts, some precedent here, does the characters, the personnel matter? Granted, it doesn't change the 6-3, but does the nature of the appointment mean that could move the dial on issues which we know are real hot button ones, you know, Roe versus Wade, this kind of thing? Is it the case that if there's a new, young, kind of left leaning or liberally inclined firebrand, that could kind of, I don't know, change the potential for something really extreme to happen, like with the Roe versus Wade ruling? Or fundamentally, the 6-3 is in and of itself the only ratio that matters?
Yeah, well, you know, it's important to note that, of course, every court is going to be different depending on the individuals that are on that. So certainly having different individuals and individuals, different experiences and different, politics are going to have some kind of effect. And it is notable, too, that Breyer was considered more of a moderate liberal. He strived for consensus, was seen as more of a centrist. So someone coming in with slightly further left views could change things a bit on that. And it's important to note, too, the justices obviously are involved in selecting which cases come to the court, as well as the opinions that they make and the way those opinions are written. So certainly the individuals do have an impact on that. With that said, again, some of these big issues that come up before the court regarding abortion, gun rights, affirmative action, I think those, the 6-3 split or sometimes a 5-4, depending on how Roberts goes on certain things, it's unlikely that those issues will swing in the other direction just with a new kind of appointment. But some of the conversations around them might look a little bit different than they would with Breyer and then with a new nominee.
Now, Julie, my sort of playful question was about, I was going to invoke the name of President Taft, who I think I'm right in saying is the only former president to subsequently serve on the Supreme Court. Is that right? I'm sure you would know these things. Could Biden not just throw an absolute crazy curveball in there and nominate Barack Obama to serve? I know I don't want to be flippant about a serious issue, but that would be kind of amazing. But clearly, though, no, it would never happen.
That is a very playful question. I don't know that Obama is looking for that role necessarily. And I mean, it is important.
He's well qualified. He's well qualified, isn't he?
He would be well qualified. I will say, you know, Biden was pretty specific about wanting to nominate a black woman. There have been black males who have served on the court before. Clarence Thomas is a current justice. Thurgood Marshall, obviously, in the past. So it was important for Biden and for some of his liberal supporters to have a black woman in that position. So that'll be my answer to that, is that I think even if he was getting pressure from Obama, he leaned back into his promise.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you. You took that question in the spirit it was intended, Julie. Thanks, though, for joining us and unpicking that one for us. That was the US political expert Julie Norman joining us here on The Briefing. Just ticking towards 22 minutes past 1300 hours in Zurich, 22 minutes past midday here in London, and a new issue of Monocle magazine hits newsstands and hopefully, possibly, doormats as well around the world today. Our editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, he's not the punchline to a joke. He's the boss, and he joins me in the studio right now. And Andrew, we gathered around this table exactly a week ago today, and we talked a little bit, I think it was on The Globalist, about the need for some levity in challenging times. But that's very much, isn't it, at the heart of the new February issue of Monocle magazine.
So it dives into the world of comedy and comedy and cartooning and satire and why we need it and why it's good to, have the right to poke fun at your kind of leaders and your betters supposedly in society. So it looks at all of these people. But I think it also throws back a question to us in a way, which is, oddly, when we spoke to many comedians, we thought that maybe this notion of wokeness would be kind of curtailing, you know, what they felt they could say on stage. And actually, some people said, look, it's more just tastes are changing and no comedian wants to die on stage, so you use material that you think would just work and make people funny. We're not really that bothered about testing these boundaries that much. What was more interesting was it kind of threw it back on the readers and us as individuals, whether we've kind of outsourced the right to be funny to professionals, and it's just us that's a bit more nervous about telling jokes. And I don't know, maybe that whole world has vanished, a bit of, like, you know, going to big dinners and dinner parties and having a joke and all these things. We live in a slightly different age. So it's about our sense of humour and the need to have a sense of humour.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting. I know, obviously, we canvassed quite a few, in inverted commas, serious people to tell us a joke and sort of demonstrate how they look on the lighter side of life. And actually, a lot of captains of industry types and people in very, very public facing figures were, in some cases, Andrew, reluctant even to enter the discussion. I wonder that's perhaps because of a perception or a misperception that to be shown to be laughing in tough times is insensitive, or shows that, or might show that you didn't care about or people, or you weren't serious about your work. But as a editor and also as someone who, you know, runs a big team of people, it's always important, even in the darkest moments, isn't it, to retain it. It helps you retain a sense of perspective.
Well, the funny thing is, here in the UK, and I don't think we see it much at the moment, but, you know, there used to be a kind of a tradition of humour being seen as a skill set in a way. So, you know, some of the best, for example, MPs questions, Prime Minister questions, rather, you would hear MPs tarrying with a Prime Minister, and there would be a lot of humour in the chamber, and somehow people landed their points better by slightly making a laugh run around the room. And I think that's the same whether you're in business, whether you're in politics. Even now, somebody who can change the mood in a room by having a bit of levity, by being funny, it's a good thing. So we want our diplomats and our business leaders not to be all earnest fools, but to be kind of people with a more kind of more depth to them in a way.
And there's a playful twinkle in Andrew Tuck's eye, listeners, I can tell you. And Andrew, just very briefly, the mag is out now. People must go and get a copy. It's about the power of humour, wit, comedy. But there's the usual heft in there as well. It's not all glib and flippant
no.
at all.
And amazingly, what you've heard, obviously, across Monocle 24 this week is, you know, we have Paige and Chris Chermak down in Kiev, and actually the big lead piece, the big long read, is by a Ukrainian writer, Artem Chek, talking about his view on society, but also he's been a conscript. He went out to the front in Donbass a few years ago. He's a reservist still, and him talking about how you navigate every single day in Kiev, trying to go to work, do your job, when you know that there's this threat of war all the time. And there's just this tiny detail in there. He says that him, all his friends, they all have a bag packed just in case something does happen and they have to flee with their families and head westwards towards the rest of Europe.
Amazing stuff. Light and shade. That's what we like, isn't it, Andrew? That is Andrew Tuck. That's the new issue of Monocle, out right now. Get yourself a copy. Right now, though, get ready for Fernando. Yes, finally, it is Thursday. It can only mean one thing. Well, it means a few things. It means it's Friday tomorrow. But what I mean, you can hear him chuckle. It's Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's shuffled into the studio. It says here, I thought you walked in quite purposefully, Fernando, to deliver. It's the weekly pop extravaganza. That is the Global Countdown. You gave us some great clues at the top of the show, Faye. Where are we headed?
We are heading to Romania. And I have to tell you, Tom, this time actually a listener asked me specifically to do Romania. I don't do this very often, but you know what?
You're granting requests
exactly.
now.
Exactly. Well, I have to be very careful with that because I
set a precedent.
Exactly, exactly. Maybe I shouldn't have mentioned that. And it's funny that you were talking here with Andrew about jokes, humor. I have to say, some of the tracks here, there is a little bit of humor. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but we will explore that. And let's say Romania, many people know as the land of the cheeky girls as well. You reminded that actually before the show.
Don't tell people I reminded you of that, Fernando. Yeah, the cheeky girls. That I don't know if they've travelled much beyond the UK borders.
Well, an excellent number two. That's what they had. I love that track.
Have a quick Google, international
yes.
listeners.
Yes.
Or maybe don't do that. Right, Faye, let's jump in. Number five, where are we starting?
We are starting with two Romanian singers, and actually one of them defined himself as a YouTuber, you know, whatever that means. Let's have a listen.
It's such a cynic, Fernando.
Exactly. Costel Bijou and Yuli Neantu with Lupi. Au, au, au.
Ai mei umblă, hai te bagă de toate se vaită, strigăm la lună de parcă suntem lupi. Au, 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 au,
au, au, dear Fernando. Oh dear. Can I just say to the listeners, Faye was dancing immediately to that. I don't know, that sounds like some kind of... Do you know what I was thinking of? Who Let the Dogs Out? Do you remember that one?
Well, similar vibes, but this time I think it's not dogs, it's wolves. Because I think that... Because au, I think that's the noise the wolves do in Romania.
Right. Is that a novelty record? Is that a serious piece?
It feels like a novelty record because, you know, as I said, he's a YouTuber. I don't even know if his main job is to be a singer. And in the video, there's a lot of kind of girls wearing bikinis with some kind of wolves masks as well. So there's
I should just check that out just in the interest of research.
Yeah, and then he said in the lyrics, we shout to the moon as if we were wolves as well. So there's a little bit of drama involved.
Yeah, it's kind of a teen wolf
exactly,
vibe.
Exactly.
A favourite of mine from the 80s, Fernando.
It's a good start. For the top five, right?
It's a start.
It's a start, exactly.
What's at number four?
Number four, we have... Well, there's a dance routine to that, but I'll tell you later. This is Alex Botea with Mana Stanga Sus, which means left hand. Let's have a listen.
Toba, că vrea fata să dea proba. Să vedem de ce e stare. Savurăm orice mișcare. Tum, ți-cat, că dugu, dum, dugu, dum. Carabane și percuții. Însă nu facem diferențe. Ca să nu ia...
Oh, that's more like it.
That's more like it.
Well, dugadung, dugadung. I like that.
A bit more... There's some traditional sounds of Romania, I would say, in that track. And I told you about the dance routine. Of course, the song's called Left Hand. So I think you have to put your left hand up and then you have to kind of gently tap your hip as well.
Okay,
so
I can do that.
I was looking at their social media. There was even grannies dancing to it, you know.
Oh, I love this.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a sweet song. I'm sure that... I don't know exactly the meaning of that track. But, you know, another kind of novelty. Quite a lot of novelty in Romania.
Getting people on the dance floor and sharing, you know, fun family moments, it gets my vote.
And I love an easy routine as well. I think even I can do that. Okay. Put my left hand up and just gently tap my hip as well. So
very nice. Fernando, number three.
Number three, a little bit more dramatic. And this is actually quite a popular band. They're from Moldova as well. And the name of the band is called Carla's Drinks. And I was wondering, why is it called Carla's Drinks? Apparently, the name was chosen because Carla is a character from the novels of John le Carré, the British espionage novelist.
Of course, yes, yes.
So that's why they decided to name the band. And the song is called Victima, which means victim. Let's have a listen.
Mi-ai schimbat și numele în telefon. Și locul meu tu iei pastile să ador. Și tu visezi că nu te vreau cum te ador. Dar totuși nu ai somn. Ești victima mea preferată dintre toate fetele. Ești prima mea de 5 ani, 5 ani.
That's a bit moodier, isn't it?
Oh, it's very moody. He says, too many waves are between us. Love dies when you don't look back.
Oh.
So it's really, really dramatic.
A bit of an air of mystery. And I maybe just because you said about John le Carré, I was thinking of somebody walking down a dark street, you know, the collar turned up. Yes. There's an air of sort of film noir about it.
And they, the band, I think they always wear masks as well. So there's another kind of...
Oh, so it's COVID secure as well.
Exactly, exactly.
This is ticking all the boxes. I like the little change of pace and tone we've set so far, from 5 to 4 to 3, Fernando. What has got nearly to the top of the tree in Romania this week?
I think number two is a nice mix of hip-hop and pop music as well. He's a legend when it comes to Romanian hip-hop. His name is Cabron, and he sings with a singer, Theo Rose. It's a woman, even though Theo could be also a man, right? The song's called Fructu Interzis, which means the forbidden fruit.
That, Fernando, feels to me like the most likely crossover track that we might hear in another market. Perhaps because it's this hip-hop pop fusion, it sounds more, a little more maybe mainstream, perhaps?
No, absolutely. And it's interesting to see Cabron's career. He started in 98, and he's really like a legend. He had a hip-hop group as well. He released many singles in Romania, and he's still there, and I think he wants to kind of sing with younger artists like Theo Rose. And as you say, it is a crossover track. It can be played in the hip-hop radio, on pop radio as well. It's a nice track.
And I always like to see the slightly more experienced amongst us.
Exactly.
Still getting there. Of course. Go in the spotlight, Fernando. You know, this is a perennial theme that, yes, I like to return, yes, to. Wow, it's been a whistle-stop tour. We're already at the top of the tree. Fernando, I don't know, could what we've heard so far inform us as to what is likely to be at number one?
Yes. Well, it's funny because number one, it feels very Romanian because she is singing like a rhythm called Taraf music, which is kind of very local, slightly folksy and gypsy kind of music from Romania. But it's the first time she's trying this genre, actually, because she's usually more of a pop singer. But this song has been a massive hit all over Romania. Let's have a listen. Her name is Oana Radu. The song is Când am o zi grea, which means when I have a hard day.
Fernando, that was not necessarily what I was expecting. I like the kind of umpa-style vibes.
It's very happy.
It's cheerful.
She's very cheerful. And she is big as well in Romania. She was a semi-finalist of The Voice of Romania. And again, continuing the tradition that you don't need to win those programs. Usually, the most successful of them, usually they're semi-finalists or they're in fourth place or fifth place or whatever. And she used to be a children's TV presenter as well.
I was going to say, it sounded a bit like a children's TV show theme.
She's very glamorous as well, I have to say. She likes
lovely stuff.
Her makeup.
My favourite was probably Carla.
Well done to Carla. I think I like the wolf one. Just for,
of course,
for the
do,
novelty kind of.
Right, that's it.
Sake.
Let's stop him there, people. Fernando, thanks as always for the Global Countdown. That is all we have time for on today's briefing, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Lillian Fawcett, and our studio manager was Chris Blackwell. My name's Tom Edwards. That's the show. Thanks for listening.